Next, we're going to hear from Doug Pomeroy, who's a member of the ARSC Technical Committee. Doug has 30 years of professional experience as a recording engineer on the staff at Columbia Recording Studios. He served there from 1969 to 1976. And since then, he's worked as an audio restoration specialist, working for many labels.
Right there. In fact, you might want to put that in your other pocket.
It's a good idea. Okay. I guess we can have the lights. The lights can come up.
Bring them up.
Okay. Yeah, they don't need to be down that much. Yeah. I see we're running late, so I'm gonna talk as fast as I can. I think that this talk is entitled Correcting Speed Instability. It probably should be titled Trying to Correct Speed Instability. In the 78 RPM era, as we all know, record companies employed a variety of different recording speeds. The remarkable thing is that the speeds themselves were so stable. I can find no published measurements concerning the cutters used during the early years of disc recording, so my impression is based only on listening experience. Well before the turn of the century, clock mechanisms had reached a high degree of perfection, and this technology was incorporated into the design of the early weight-driven cutters and made for excellent performance. Governors allowed speed to be maintained with good stability, even though the actual RPM might vary slightly from one lathe to the next, as we all know. In the electrical era, with the development of a 60 hertz synchronous motor, a worm gear ratio of 46 to 1 was used to produce a reliable turntable rotation of 78.26086957 and so on, RPM, and this speed quickly became standard thanks to the relationship of Western Electric and Victor Records. It is remarkably rare, in my experience, to find a shellac pressing which was recorded with audibly unstable speed. My experience with cylinders, which is very limited, is that they can be very stable. Not that they always are. Note that I am referring to long-term speed fluctuations, where a recording gets faster and faster, or slower and slower, or goes up and down over an extended period of time. I am not talking about the playback problems caused by discs which are warped, or out of round, or simply pressed off-center. Speed instabilities fall into two main categories, and magnetic tape recordings suffer dearly from both. One of the dirty secrets of analog recording. Short-term deviations such as flutter and wow, and number two, the long-term fluctuations of speed over time, also known as drift. Wow and flutter are essentially, as you all know, regular periodic fluctuations up and down in the recording speed, wow generally being defined as the same as flutter, only slower. These instabilities are caused by many, many things, including drive motor defects, eccentricities in the shape and motion of moving parts, tape path contamination, scrapes, diction, and so on. The NAB standard, unweighted for tape flutter and wow, is given as less than 0.15% at 15 IPS, 0.2 at 7.5, and 0.25% at 3.75. The long-term drift can be caused by tension variations from the beginning to end of a reel of tape, tape slippage due to a worn capstan surface or inadequate pinch roller pressure, and unstable capstan speed due to badly worn motor bearings and or lack of lubrication. All of this assumes power from the power company at a perfectly constant 60 hertz. Portable recorders often rely on batteries, and when batteries become weak, the recording speed is sure to be affected. The NAB standard for speed is plus or minus 0.2% at all three tape speeds. The EIA standard for disc rotation at 45 or 33 and a third is plus or minus 0.5 for a total of, twice that. The small error between the speed of tape travel at the head and tail of the same reel of tape has always been tolerated in professional tape recorders and has never been entirely eliminated in any of them. However, the introduction of servo motors in the 70s produced significant improvement from 0.2% down to less than a tenth of a percent. This type of error is the result of the change in load as seen by the drive mechanisms, both the capstan and reel motors, when most of the tape is on the feed reel as compared when most of the tape is on the take-up reel. This problem is not serious when the tape is played back unaltered on the same machine on which it was recorded, since it will speed up and slow down during playback just as it did during recording. But there can be a problem when a tape is edited and segments are placed in different locations on some other reel, as commonly happens when final takes are pulled from sessions and assembled onto a master reel. The problem becomes worse if the reel hub sizes are changed at any point, since this change alters the load seen by the drive system. Finally, the problem may surface again if a subsequent dubbing master is made, as was common practice at all the record companies, since this usually adds still more small pitch errors for the reasons just stated. A well-known speed test is to record 3,000 hertz at the head of a reel of tape and then again at the end of the same reel. Splice the two recorded sections together and play across them and hear the inevitable pitch change at the splice, which reflects the recording speed difference. Or more simply, record a tone at the head of a full reel of tape, turn the tape over and play it backwards and compare the tone with the source used. You will hear, it'll always be different. If you've got good ears, certainly. The performance of non-professional machines, such as portable disc and open reel tape recorders, wire recorders, and cassette recorders, is invariably poorer, I'm not telling you anything new, than professional machines. One of the indisputable advantages of digital recording is its rock-solid pitch stability, which is far better than anything known before in the history of recording. What can be done to correct recordings made with unstable speed? First, make sure the problem is a recorded error and not being introduced by the playback equipment. This is easier said than done. In fact, a whole paper could be given perhaps on that subject, but leave that aside for the moment. Obviously, you just want to make sure that your playback equipment is the very best possible that you can get and do perform all the tests, standard tests necessary to confirm that your equipment is as good as it can be. Number one, if the speed error is constant, simply too fast or too slow, use a VeriSpeed control. These controls are available on many professional and consumer tape decks, some turntables, and even some cassette players. It's fairly easy. Using a tuning fork, pitch pipe, oscillator, or other reliable pitch reference as a guide. While listening to both the guide and the program material, adjust the VeriSpeed control until the program sounds in tune with the reference pitch. Correction of a constant pitch error may also be implemented digitally by resampling the program at a different sampling rate. Digital processing also allows changing of pitch and duration independently, something that I don't think was ever possible with analog tape, although I believe the Germans had developed a spinning head analog tape recorder, which I think was a kind of sampling device, which would allow these two variables to be altered independently. Two, if there is flutter and wow from tape or misshapen discs, take two aspirin and don't call me in the morning. In short, there is at this point in time no known cure. However, we are getting closer to one, as I will explain in a moment. Discs pressed off-center can be recentered before playing, and should be, although this requires some ingenuity and practice. Three, if there are gradual or eccentric speed fluctuations over long periods of time, one may try to follow these fluctuations, listening to both a suitable guide, such as a reference tone, and the program, and making real-time adjustments of the VeriSpeed control, trying to keep the two in tune. This is exceedingly difficult, which I don't need to tell anybody who's ever tried it. However, if multiple such attempts are made and the results all recorded onto a separate recorder, they may subsequently be spliced together to create an acceptable, albeit not perfect, composite. In a few cases, it may be possible to detect some hum in the recording from both disc and tape sources, this hum having leaked into an amplification circuit from the AC power line. With a very good filter or parametric equalizer, it is sometimes possible to boost the level of the hum so that it can be heard easily and then compared with a constant source sounding the original frequency, 60 hertz here, 50 hertz in Europe, and allowing VeriSpeed adjustment to be made as previously described. And Steve has mentioned yesterday that if you could really get that 60 hertz to be a perfect sine wave, you would also eliminate flutter and wow, because the flutter and wow would show up on that waveform as harmonics. But nobody, again, nobody's done this yet, but it's a good thought. Similarly, with tape recordings, it may be possible to reduce the speed by perhaps a factor of 4, thus making the bias frequency audible. Although different brands of recorders have used different bias frequencies, this waveform can, in any case, serve as a high-resolution indicator of recording and playback speed stability. 4. It has long seemed to me that given the state of the art of digital signal processing, it ought to be possible for someone to develop a processor which, on the basis of harmonic analysis and perhaps other factors, could detect pitch fluctuations beyond those short-term ones which occur naturally in music, such as the vibrato in a singer's voice, and generate a signal representing the error, which could then be applied to correct the pitch digitally. In the spring 1990 ARSC journal, there appeared an article titled "New Possibilities in Audio Restoration" by former ARSC member John S. Allen, in which the development of just such digital processors is envisioned. We do have devices designed to optimize synchronization of the two tracks of a stereo tape recording. According to Mr. Allen, Lexicon has a circuit of this type for use with Dolby surround sound. More recently, Cedar have done the same with their azimuth corrector. The Cedar AZ-1 was designed to correct the time base error which results when a stereo recording is copied with its two tracks poorly synchronized, which results when a tape head is poorly aligned with the recorded signal on the tape being played. When the source recording is subsequently lost or destroyed, we are left with a copy which has a recorded error, which cannot be corrected by adjusting the playback heads while playing that copy. Cedar's device was designed to correct this in the digital domain automatically. It could also be used to optimize the alignment of any stereo tracks, although this is no substitute for tuning the left and right sum when making stereo transfers. There exist today several computer programs which are moving in the direction of being able to correct drifting pitch. A British company called Vocaline makes software designed to improve the synchronization of dialogue when films are being dubbed into a second language. And it uses not only detection of amplitude, but also frequency spectrum analysis, which is kind of clever, but is not designed to deal with music. An American company, Mark of the Unicorn, makes software called Digital Performer, which will carry out retards and accelerandos once points of alignment have been manually entered. Manually entering these points is the hard part. Presumably, the adjustment necessary between this point and this point, which is a change in both duration and pitch, would be done properly, but try entering all these points where your ear tells you that the pitch of a program is either going down or going up. I haven't had a chance to play with this, but it does exist. As I was preparing this talk, I learned of a new program made by a company called Antares, I think it was previously known as Jupiter, called AutoTune. And I was going to make a slide of this. I didn't, because you wouldn't be able to read it anyway. But this company in California makes a device which is very interesting, and I was unable to get either of the two pro audio dealers in New York City to demonstrate this for me hands-on before this conference. But it is in the stores. It runs about $500, $600. It's a plug-in in a digital audio workstation. What its limitations are, I do not know yet. The ad states that it was designed to work on solo recordings, like a solo voice on a multi-track recording with a singer who can't sing in tune. And I'm told all the recording studios are buying this. How would it process orchestral music? We don't know. The ad says, and I quote, "The rate at which the pitch adjustment is made is controlled by a slider. A very quick adjustment can remove a vibrato. A slower adjustment can leave a vibrato unmodified, but accurately adjust the pitch center to be in tune." This, we are here approaching the realm of flutter and wow. What will it do with non-music recordings, spoken word, for instance? How much surface noise will it tolerate? Will it track long-term pitch drift? Even if auto-tune, and anybody who wants to see this can come up later, and even if it offers less than we would like, I agree with John Allen that it is only a matter of time before successful software is developed. I hope it's within our lifetimes. I should imagine every sound archive in the world would be interested in such a development. Much of Mr. Allen's article deals with the subject of synchronization. He envisions digital processors which will allow, and I quote, synchronous playback of multiple copies of analog recordings to achieve an improved signal-to-noise ratio. Number two, removal of print-through and groove echoes without degradation of the desired signal. Number three, easy generation of true stereo recordings by synchronizing separate mono recordings made at the same time and location. Number four, automated or semi-automated correction of time-based errors of analog recordings, meaning to flutter and wow, such as those caused by disk warp and mechanical speed variations, end quote. I believe the idea of using more than one copy of the same recording played synchronously as a means of improving the signal-to-noise ratio was originally put forward by Walter Welch in connection with the transferring of cylinders. Certainly, the technique suggests itself in the case of cylinders, since several could theoretically be slipped onto one long mandrel. Being rotated by a single motor, all the copies would stay in sync. I have not had time to fully research this subject, but I have been in communication with Mr. Allen, who lives in Massachusetts, and he helped me understand it. He tells me he spoke to Welch, and that Welch only used turntables, and that Welch never achieved good synchronization. I believe Mr. Welch is no longer with us. Information theory, which was Mr. Allen's specialty, tells us that two different versions of random noise will add together to produce an output 3 dB higher than either one. The two copies of the same audio recording, however, are virtually identical, and so the audio program will add together and double the output, yielding a voltage gain of 6 dB. So we have a noise getting 3 dB louder, the program getting 60 dB louder. The overall improvement is the difference, namely approximately 3 dB. Every time the number of disks involved doubles, there is another improvement of approximately 3 dB. As he pointed out, 8 copies of the same disk played simultaneously would therefore provide a theoretical maximum improvement in the signal-to-noise ratio of 9 dB, which is a lot. By extension, an additional 3 dB beyond that would require a total of 16 copies of the same record, all perfectly synchronized. In addition to the surface noise, it must be said that there, which is different on each disc, there is always some recorded noise in the grooves of the metal stamper, which of course is not reduced by this procedure. An obvious drawback, which should be mentioned, if the surface noise of one of the copies is extremely bad, in comparison with the others, it will seriously reduce the improvement which its inclusion would otherwise produce. For this reason, the copies used should all ideally be more or less equal in terms of noise level. But because the discs obtained will probably not be all ideal in these respects, the maximum 3D improvement will in practice probably turn out to be less. Also, very loud pops and clicks should first be attenuated or deleted from the copies being played for obvious reasons, as long as this can be done without shortening the program, for the obvious reason. Mr. Allen has said regarding very rare discs, quote, the fewer copies there are and the noisier they are, the less you can do. All of this may explain why this is not normally undertaken. It's all very well to talk about theoretical possibilities. It is something else, again, to obtain useful results. Not long ago, I found myself with three shellac pressings of the same Hoagy Carmichael recording, and I decided to try to synchronize them. I played each record and stored the audio in a separate file on a computer hard disk. The rotation of my SP15 turntable is said to be accurate to 0.002%. It immediately became apparent to me that this is not good enough. The music waveforms from each disk transfer must fit one on top of the next perfectly in order to double in amplitude. Perfectly means perfectly. I came to realize that the only way to achieve this would be to have multiple turntables with perfect linkage, all driven by one perfect motor. or to have the multiple platters, slide number two, for those who, is he asleep yet? Oh. Sorry, Fred. This is for you Rube Goldberg lovers. Or to have multiple platters stacked and driven by one basic table. I actually thought about doing this because, you know, it's within the realm of possibility.
They made a tape machine like that.
Yeah. Mr. Allen says, even this will not do the job properly since the slight differences between the timing of the recordings will remain due to warp, eccentricity, and these must be eliminated with a device such as the Cedar azimuth corrector. What is required is synchronization to about 10 microseconds. This is 72 degrees phase shift at 20 kilohertz. Incredible, but you know, you can understand that if you really want this thing to work, it has to be that close to absolutely perfect. The copies would also need to be queued up very carefully to start at the same instant, next slide, at the beginning of the music, since otherwise any slight deviations in motor speed, which are inevitable since there is no motor which runs at absolutely constant speed, except perhaps an atomic clock, which is not a motor, would produce wow, which would occur at different points in each of the transfers. You know, this I've blown this up a million times, of course, but this is a very small amount of deviation in the turntable speed, and this is maybe a fraction of a second. That the music starts in each of these transfers, and so you would think that would be very good. Later on, those points of where the music starts can be synchronized in the computer digitally. Next slide. The problem is that this wow in each of the transfers is not. The problem is not overcome by precisely synchronizing the start times later on. As you can see, you can get the music to start exactly at the beginning of the music, but that little wow now occurs at different points in each of the recordings and will throw this perfect synchronization that you need off. So naturally, the styli cartridges and phono preamps would also need to be matched carefully. Because of the many practical difficulties, I was unable to carry out this experiment, but as you can see, I thought about it. I am very curious to know of any work by others along these lines. As a footnote, those who are interested primarily in cylinder recordings may have seen the article, probably didn't, but I have a copy of it with me, by John McDonough in the July 18th, 1985 issue of the Wall Street Journal, in which the following statement appears. A band would face a battery of a dozen cylinder machines and play the same piece 30 times in a 3-hour session. This would produce 360 cylinders ready for shipping. If any two from the same performance could be located, they would constitute the necessary two separate tracks of a stereo recording. In the same article, it talks about Brad Kay, the collector in California who found the two Duke Ellington Victors and from a different, two different microphones feeding two lathes and synchronized them and issued them on LP. At this point, you may be wondering what happened to Charlie Parker. Well, last summer, I received a DAT made from an analog original, which contained a hitherto unreleased recording of Parker's performance at the Rockland Palace in Harlem in 1952. Portions of that concert had been issued previously on various LPs. The LP's recordings were derived from a recording made by one Frank Duval, who was in the audience that night. Whether he used a wire or tape recorder is not clear. What is clear is that his recorder speed was wildly unsteady. Worse, the LP issues made no attempt to transfer the material at anything like the correct pitch. Furthermore, both the LPs and the new unissued recording on DAT were incomplete, and both had been edited differently, usually to eliminate solos by the other musicians. However, it was decided to try to piece together these two recordings to create the most complete possible record of the entire concert. I would only do this for Charlie Parker. This was a formidable task. I'm going to play first a sample of the DAT tape. This was the much better of the two recordings. But I'm playing a tiny fragment. It goes very fast. I hope you can hear it, where they did make an edit. Sample one. Thank you. That was the end. Okay, you can play number two. This is the LP without it, with played at 33 and a third. You see, here we go into a guitar solo, which they had cut out in the other one. You can play in the next. This is my final combining the two. You got back to first one. Hold on. You got a pause on that thing? It's okay. It's okay. Does it take the same amount of time? The best laid plans. Okay, this is the final. Okay, hold it. Now, the next three, I'll let you play them without stop, so we won't back up. The next three are, again, the same thing, same sort of thing you've just heard. First, the dat with the animal recording. That's okay. and then the LP, and then the... That was an edit point in the DAT. This is the LP without any edits, played at 33 and a third. Again, we go into a guitar solo. Mundo Love, poor guy. They cut him out. Not the LP, but the other one. Now, this is the end result where I put the two together. I'll go ahead. You can let that play, but it stopped at the end of the music. In some cases, I found I had two recordings of the same performance. Including these you just heard. And in the case of Lester Leaps In, I decided, since it's such an extraordinary solo, I decided to see if I could synchronize two of them to produce a kind of stereo. Since there was no digital processor which would do this automatically, I developed the following technique. The digital recording, which we know came from analog tape, seemed to have very steady pitch, so it was designated as the guide track. You want to play, just play seven, okay? And this is the... It played at 33 and a third. It goes much faster. It's 7%, at least 7% fast. The problem is that it's not only fast, but that it drifts. And this performance is... It's 4 minutes and 28 seconds long. Next, I'm going to play, just to put the two in the two channels, just to show you what happens if you synchronize the start and just let them run. The objective was to align the LP to the other recording, and this was done in the following way. Number one, the LP was transferred to tape, and the turntable speed adjusted, And you can play the next sample here. You'll hear a B flat from a tone generator in one channel, and the LP starting in the other channel too fast, and then it drops down too low, and then it comes back more or less to B flat. It doesn't have to be perfect, and it isn't. But if you can hear the B flat, okay, hold it. The guide track and the LP track were uploaded to the computer as a stereo sound file, and the same musical event near the start of both, slide five, was found and marked. This could not be highly accurate, since it depended on trying to see the same musical event in two vastly different looking recordings made from two microphones at widely differing positions. We know this just by ear, that the analog recording, which is came in on DAT, has saturation, both tape saturation, I think, and overload of the microphone preamp, which means that Charlie Parker may have been, you know, inches from the mic at times. He wanders around. The other microphone, I would say, is probably 20 feet away in the audience because it's at least 50% its noise. What you try to see when you align things visually, or try to align things visually, you scrub that area and you say, well, yes, that is the same musical event. Next slide. And then you blow this up. I find this is the best way to synchronize things. Blow it up and scrub it some more until you can actually, this is time consuming and it requires good eye and ear coordination because you're scrubbing and listening at the same time. But it's possible to find the same musical event in both these files, as I say, even though there's a time difference between them, and the EQ is radically different. Having found one point of sync between the two recordings, the two were played and quickly went out of sync, and then finally came back into sync at a later point. At that point, another mark was made where the same musical event could be seen and aligned in the two files. The segment in between the two sync points, next slide, was designated region one. Just to say, okay, between these two points, the music goes all over the place, but eventually it starts in sync and it comes back in sync. This is what's happening over time. I guess it's self-explanatory. The guide track has a little bit of waver in it. It's not absolutely solid, but the other program, you have almost perfect sync right here, not exactly, but you know, at one point in time you can find two such points. I'm almost through. somewhere near the middle of region one, next slide, a point was chosen where the same musical event in both recordings could be clearly seen to be out of alignment. Two segments were then were defined, one being too long and the other being too short by the same amount. And as you can see by the magic formula, if you tell the computer to make the smaller of those two the same as the guide region, and the larger, smaller, this can be done. Let me tell you, the two segments were then defined, one being too long and the other too short by the same amount. These sub-segments were measured very accurately down to the level of a single sample. Digital signal processing was then applied to compress the long segment and expand the short one by the same amount. This forced alignment of the event in the middle of the region. As for accurately aligning all of the music between the original points of synchronization, this technique produces only a gross approximation. However, the procedure was followed and repeated for smaller and smaller subregions to pull more and more points in the music into alignment. Note, however, that perfect synchronization can never be achieved by this means, since the compress and expand processing that I applied was a constant correction without changing pitch, whereas what is really required is a continual correction of both duration and pitch. The accelerando and retard functions mentioned earlier might have been of some use if applied here. Note also, finally, that digital signal processing degrades audio quality. The more it's done, the more the audio is degraded until artifacts finally become audible. The stereo version of Lester Leaps In has been issued on Jazz Classics 5014, and I want to acknowledge the assistance of John Allen. You want to play track 11, you don't need to hear the whole thing, but This is the final result. One recording starts later than the other, so you don't get the stereo until a certain point. But I want to thank John Allen for his contributions. I guess actually the only people who are hearing the stereo are the people who are more or less in the center of the room. But it took me overall approximately 2 months to correct these 4 minutes. I didn't work 8 hours a day on it, but from beginning to end it took about 2 months. So we should all hope for the day that this can be magically automated. The possibilities will be interesting. Okay, thank you very much. If there are any questions, I'm no expert on this stuff, but I thought I learned something by thinking about it. No questions?
Okay. Thanks.
Great. Thank you.
I need to grab.
What's it worth to you?